You know ID in the D in the L day. ID in the D in the F E A. You know ID in the D in the L day. ID in the D in the F E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 227 of the Fabulous Peltoncast, sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Peltoncast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the 1-0 Seattle Seahawks.
Hello. Since we last recorded our regular weekly pod last Tuesday, we have recorded NFL over-unders and fantasy football talk. Peltoncast live from home, spectacular Seahawks season preview, etc., and a recap of the Seahawks season opening win at Atlanta with our friend Ben Baldwin of The Athletic Seattle. And I can only assume that you have already listened, all of the listener have already listened to all 4 hours of those podcasts.
Absolutely, and most importantly, we'd really love to thank everybody who helped us make Peltoncast live from home as much of a success as any Zoom live event can possibly be. Most importantly, to the guests who joined us for that one, to Mina Kimes, to Lenny, special guests on it, if you didn't listen / watch, to DJ Infrared, of course, throughout the entire episode. To Chris and Randy, the co-hosts of Talkin' Taco Time, Brooke Olsendam for joining us for a legendary Talkin' Taco Time. Really groundbreaking Talkin' Taco Time in many ways. For Mike Sean Duggar and Natalie Weiner for joining us for a Seahawks season preview, which was excellent, everything about it. And then finally to the decider, Zach Whitman, for joining us to talk about Seattle's best teriyaki.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering whether you're going to give him a no thanks on that one after he called you the Chris Caliza of teriyaki.
And then even more importantly, though, to everybody who came to the event, who logged into the Zoom, who watched, who listened, who participated, who got free pizza, who might have won hats. It was just awesome to have so many people there, to see everybody's faces, and to really just have a good time during such strange times that we're living in right now.
Yeah. Also, to everybody who helped out behind the scenes, most specifically the famous cousin Katie, did all the graphics work. She made the awesome custom backgrounds that only Chris and I managed to actually have working, but she made those for us. Doing a lot of the technical work on the Zoom. Also, Mrs. Fantasy Genius and Katie's husband, Ben, for their roles, helping to moderate the chat and make sure that everything was running smoothly. So we couldn't have done this without them either. Should we drink a toast to all of these people?
Absolutely, we should.
What are we drinking this week?
We are drinking from our good friends at Silver City Brewery in Silverdale, Washington. This, I believe, would be the weekend for it, or one of the weekends for it. This is the Silver City Oktoberfest Lager. Oktoberfest Lager. I can read now that I have glasses. Celebrate the season with tradition and authenticity. This classic amber lager presents rich malty sweetness and spicy hop character.
All right, that sounds good.
Roast.
By the way, the official Oktoberfest in Bavaria was canceled due to the pandemic, but it would have been around this time, it appears, because the 2019 date was September 21st and 2021 is September 18th. So somewhere in the midst of those two, I take it.
That's what I said.
I was just confirming.
Most importantly, though, I want to address something here just off the top.
Okay.
Which I don't think we're going to be talking any further about the live show, right?
I don't know if we're going to get into any specifics about it necessarily.
I guess most importantly, if you weren't there, if you haven't listened, go and listen. It was a very fun time. We had excellent conversations with almost everybody. But this is not specifically about Zach.
Oh.
But I feel like the idea, which is a little bit pervasive throughout some of the Peltoncast community, that I have questionable food takes after not choosing Toshi's teriyaki, a teriyaki in Mill Creek, Washington, as Seattle's best teriyaki, or by last year voting for Tats sandwiches ahead of Maono chicken sandwich, that I have bad food takes. And this is just like such an absurd perspective to have after these two votes. Like the idea, Yoshino teriyaki is not bullshit.
No one's saying it is.
Tats Delicatessen, like, these are legit competitors for these awards, right?
They're legit competitors. That's why they're finalists. What they are not, most critically, is winners of Seattle's, our search for Seattle's best. Because you were outvoted.
We've had the same decider for every single one of these events.
I mean,
and I think we saw Randy post about Yoshino teriyaki and criticize it, and he got ratioed on Twitter.
He did. He absolutely did.
So I'm really just shocked and appalled by this idea that I don't have good takes about food.
You know what? It's fair. It checks out to me. I got to tell you. I actually went and talked a little bit more about teriyaki, including Yoshino, on the Out West pod that came out on Tuesday with the listener Daniel Sally. And so that was a lot of fun to get into. He was the one who really highlighted Randy's post and took it to the O'Day community, where naturally Yoshino is a lunch staple. I learned that apparently if you order the O'Day half and half, that's how you get half rice and half yakisoba with your teriyaki.
The O'Day half and half?
The O'Day is spicy chicken, specifically. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was very important to learn.
We're getting Yoshino sneaks here?
We are, yes.
And you're telling me this is not Seattle's best teriyaki? Like, come on, people.
Who said... It's not like the alternatives are Seattle's best teriyaki and Seattle's worst teriyaki. Also, it sort of is Seattle's best teriyaki because obviously Mill Creek is not Seattle.
I don't really... Well, yes. I don't really pay attention to political talking heads unless I worked with them in a podcast space. But I don't really know anything about Chris Kliz's takes on things, in particular teriyaki. But I'm pretty sure that this is an insult. And if you're talking to somebody who – you were on a podcast with somebody today who thinks that Yoshino is the best teriyaki in Seattle.
I mean, I was on the podcast with him yesterday, but yes, it came out today.
This is not like an outlandish opinion is what I'm saying.
No, I don't think it's an outlandish opinion. I don't think that the response that you're getting is primarily because of Yoshino.
It's because of what? Tats Delicatessen? I feel even more passionately about that as the best sandwich in Seattle.
Unita over Loretta's has loomed large, I think, in the public's consciousness, and rightfully so. Loretta's is retroactively recognized as the winner of Seattle's Best Burger, even though it was not technically voted Seattle's Best Burger.
It's obviously Seattle's Best Burger, but that's because we're judging all of it. And, you know, I think we've gotten better at doing that. But when, like, you even mentioned that the Toshis that you had last time, not to put you on blast here, that the Toshis that we had, when judging it as Seattle's best teriyaki, you were like, it wasn't that good.
It's not like the dunk contest where you threw out the scores from the first round, which is a terrible idea, by the way.
You don't ever go and get a Maono chicken sandwich and you're like, well, that was a horseshit Maono chicken sandwich.
I've had some that are better than others, but no. Maono sets, but you're right. That's why Maono is so clearly Seattle's best sandwich.
I've never had a bad pastrami. There's never been a time where I was like, yeah, they just didn't have any pastrami in it.
Like, that is not a fair comparison.
No Russian dressing. Like, I'm telling you, every pastrami is a perfect pastrami. Every Maono chicken sandwich is a perfect chicken sandwich. I mean, those two are, they're so good.
I don't
good.
Think that level exists at teriyaki. Teriyaki is a different kind of food.
Every time I've had Yoshino, it's been great.
All two times?
I literally am just, I've had it three times now.
And
right?
It was so great that you couldn't tell for sure. No, you've only had it twice.
I guess twice.
But it was so great that you couldn't tell for sure which one was Toshino. you couldn't tell for sure which one was Yoshino and which one was Teriyaki Madness. Remember that?
They're both very good. Teriyaki Madness easily could have been in the final in this competition.
It easily could have, yes.
So I just...
I think Zach might have picked it based on his sauce preferences. He's going for that viscous sweet nexus for sure.
anyway, this Chris Kaliza of food takes is just... It is not appropriate for these particular food takes. Even you agree with this. There's a little bit. Look. Your name is in the fucking the podcast title. Nobody calls it the Carcino Cast.
well, who's fault is that?
We understand. Everybody's all about ESPN's Kevin Pelton here. We all have to, bow down to the ESPN's Kevin Pelton throne when it comes to teriyaki. Look, I get what the deal is.
I'm just saying one of us has takes that are more popular with the public.
I don't see. That's the part that I'm not sure is true. I think that this is the point that I keep coming back to, which is I feel like if you go onto these streets, my takes are more popular. Like you tend to enrapture the Peltoncast world in a way that people are willing to agree with you, right? You're like the nerd's favorite of these items, right? But like the people who are out there going to get teriyaki on a day-to-day basis are going to Yoshino Teriyaki and feeling passionate about it.
Yeah, it turns out that there are a lot more people in First Hill than there are in Mill Creek. I don't know that that's a fair comparison here. Toshi's not working his magic in the heart of downtown Seattle anymore.
Those are my people, though. Those are the people who are out there saying this is Seattle's best teriyaki.
Mostly people are saying that Seattle's best teriyaki is whatever is closest to them.
I also, I love the idea that I'm going to frame Toshi's as a bougie teriyaki. But like, I'm out there just representing the working class teriyakis, right?
I mean, sure. I don't know that Yoshino is more working class than Teriyaki Madness or Ichiro or, any of a number of ones.
No, it just happened to win among those teriyakis.
It just happened to because of the fact that I didn't push you on that one.
Because nobody can differentiate between two different teriyakis.
I can differentiate between... You give me the Pepsi challenge of teriyaki and I am confident... Are we going to have to do a taste test like we did the cheap beer taste test once upon a time?
Blind teriyaki taste test. No, I think I'm good on teriyaki for a little while.
I am kind of like, it's going to be nice to eat something else. We'll talk about something we ate later in the pod, but first we should get to the rest of our toasts here. Next up, a happy birthday to Pete Carroll, as Natalie Reiner reminded us during Peltoncast Live from Home. The NFL's oldest head coach turned 69 years young on Tuesday. You're supposed to say nice.
I'm not going to do it.
No, wow. To Jordan Morris.
There we go.
Voted MLS Player of the Week after scoring the opening goal and adding three assists in the Sounders' record-setting win last Thursday over San Jose. And then lastly, we lost a legend earlier this week, Ed Pepple, who died Monday at age 88 after battling cancer. The legendary basketball coach who spent 42 years as the head coach for Mercer Island, the winningest coach in Washington State high school basketball history with 952 wins, had four state titles, most recently in 1999. Pepple retired in 2009, I should say. Steve Hawes, uncle of Spencer and the one who played in the NBA, and Quinn Snyder among the stars he coached. So definitely a towering figure, and saw that Quinn Snyder was quite emotional talking to the Seattle Times about this. All right, should we talk about Seattle food?
As long as we don't talk about teriyaki anymore.
Oh, by the way, we should talk a little bit about pizza. And our friends at Pagliacci, who, first off, thanks to them for being so generous to sponsor a number of gift cards so that the listener could enjoy, even though we couldn't have them cater like we have at past live shows in person, a handful of listeners were able to enjoy Delivery Poliachi during the show, which was pretty awesome to see. And we also had Poliachi ahead of the live show. What did you go with?
I went with pepperoni, just keeping it, you know, neutral for the family. And then I got like pepperoni and onion and mushroom.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I went with the two seasonals that they have going right now, which is the truffle potato and then the prosciutto fig. So
I was surprised. This was a little adventurous for you.
I mean, I think I may have had the prosciutto fig before. I don't think I've had the truffled potato. Like, it seems strange to have potatoes on pizza. It's a starch on a starch. But it's also like it's potatoes and cheese. It's kind of like the concept of cheese fries in a way here. So that was quite good. And the prosciutto fig, I'm not the world's biggest fig guy, but still a tasty combination. So check those out during their run as seasonals. The main thing we want to talk about this week is a place we have been long overdue in visiting. Birria Tijuana in Burien. It's located like a place that I will drive by it occasionally when I'm running errands, but wasn't introduced to this until the Seattle Times wrote about this spot and how popular it was back in late February, pretty much right before we became aware of the spread of COVID-19 in the Seattle community. So therefore, you know, it's taken a while to actually get there. But they've been quite successful. It was opened last summer in Burien by married couple Genevieve Arias and Freddie Zavala, and they have since opened up additional locations in Lakewood and Everett. I don't know. I'm going to guess you weren't that familiar with birria.
No, I'd never had it as far as I know.
So it's native to Jalisco and specifically Guadalajara, where it's traditionally made with goat. But the Tijuanan version that we're enjoying from birria Tijuana is birria de res, which is beef, and they make it with chuck steak. So what makes these tacos unique, very different from the traditional taco if you go to a taco truck, is basically that after stewing the birria in adobo of various spices for an extended period of time and then cooking that, apparently some of that sauce is ladled onto the taco shells, or the tortillas, I guess, before they are fried up, and they do cheese on there as well. And then the tradition is to eat it with a consomme of beef drippings and dunk the tacos in there. It is so rich.
It's basically like a Tijuana French dip.
That's, yeah, more or less what it is, yeah.
Honestly, you can't even really compare it to, say, like a taco truck taco. Just on every single level, it is a different experience. You know, the tortilla is different, the meat is different, the inside is different, the dipping in, the consomme is definitely different.
I mean, I don't know if the tortilla is that different, but the way they're frying it is wildly different.
Well, that's what makes it different.
Yeah.
Like, it's sort of like, it's rich and crunchy.
Although also soft because of the fact that, you know, the juices of the meat have basically caused it to not get – it's not like eating a hard shell taco.
No.
You know, and also, you know, it's not going to crumble and come apart like that. I appreciated that they're doubling up on the tortillas there. That's kind of necessary as it turns out. But, I mean, the combination was outstanding. It was long overdue to get there.
The whole thing, Jan was roasting us for not having gone yet.
Was she?
Yeah.
I mean, she's probably
telling
right
her about it. She's like, I've known about that place for a long time. She hasn't been there. Just literally that she knew about it beforehand.
The Seattle Times story?
Yes, Jan is able to read the Seattle Times. This is one time I'll get the Seattle Times that they were on something ahead of us. No, Jan was just like, I read about that a long time ago. Like, all right, great. It was incredible. I really don't know what else to say about it. Like, this is up there with some of the richest food that we've had, but the flavor was just impressive when you're eating it. You know, there's nothing, sometimes you'll have like a food truck taco and it can be a little bit dry. And this was anything but. The only thing that I would say is for me, maybe similar to hot chicken, it's like a 24-hour experience. and I ate a fuckload of food, and it's very rich food. So I had a burrito, and when I – did you see the burrito? Did you gander upon it?
No. I mean, there was, you know, probably at the bottom of the bag, and there was like multiple boxes. So I just looked, opened up the top box, which had like eight of the you want to get the cheese taco specifically, by the way. Make sure to get the – I mean, maybe you don't want the cheese, but you want the cheese.
You want the cheese. What would you describe the cheese as? Is it a cotija cheese, or is it like a mozzarella?
I'm not sure because of the fact that it's just so melted that the original consistency is kind of lost, but that's perfect. It was
gooey. That's exactly what you're looking for.
Yeah.
The burrito was like 14 pounds. You should have looked at it. And you were questionable. You were skeptical about the burrito because you were like, this is Tijuana food. They don't have burritos there. And I was looking at the picture and just like, I can agree with that. And typically I would go with, you know, whatever specifically the specialty was. I couldn't look at that picture of the burrito and not get it.
What else was in the burrito? Was it just birria?
It's basically the meat and cheese melted together, which is excellent, and then beans and rice. But then the tortilla is a little bit different than the tacos because it's encompassing everything. It's a little bit larger. And then so I just took all that. I took a bunch of the like pico mix that they included and the cilantro and shit like that. And then I just dunked it all into the consomme.
Okay. I guess I can get behind that.
It wasn't that different from the tacos, I suppose I'd say.
Except it was enormous.
Larger.
How?
Well, I actually had to take the consomme and drizzle it on top.
Because you couldn't fit it in there?
It might have fallen apart into the consomme.
That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, because it's two giant halves cut in half.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense looking at the photos here.
But yeah, I mean, it was freaking excellent. You know, it comes with these giant, of course, I'm sure you didn't eat them, these giant grilled onions in the box. Like, did you eat those?
No, I took one of the jalapeno
peppers. I'm the one who's being roasted for my food takes over here. You don't eat tomatoes. You don't eat onions. Did you eat cilantro?
Yeah. Okay. I'll occasionally eat onions.
You've eaten an onion. But it was just like, the whole thing is such an impressive package when you look at it, right? I like, it's a unique experience. It's similar, but very unique.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's no other taco you've tried unless it's specifically a birria taco will compare to it. I think it's fair to say.
So, but yeah, I mean, the only thing for me was because of how much food it was and because of how rich it was, I definitely didn't eat until like 4 p.m. the next day. I went like 20 hours without eating after this meal.
I feel like I had three tacos, and that was the precise right amount.
I did the burrito and then a single taco. I thought about doing two tacos and the burrito, but then I might have just keeled over and died.
Cannot recommend that anyone attempt that.
I would highly recommend this though.
Yeah, we're going to go back for sure. Something to look forward to, announced this week, a crossover event, not a crossover pod.
Crossover pod.
I did want to call it that, between Dick's Drive-In Restaurants and Eduardo Jordan, the proprietor of June Baby and Solare, in Seattle, you know, a Beard Award-winning chef. So he's going to, from October 16th to 18th, take over the Queen Anne Dix location as part of Rezzy's The Classics Remix series. Per Eater Seattle, the takeout menu will offer pimento cheese deluxes.
Oh, God.
Fries with Cajun sauce.
Oh!
And this actually might be the one I'm most excited about. This, a spiced sweet potato cookie shake for $17.50. Tickets will go on sale to the public through Rezzy on September 24th, and we will be right there first in line.
Welcome to 2020, where we're buying advanced tickets to the food pop-up. We're trying to get in on the Amex pre-sale. Like, we're buying tickets for the Rolling Stones to the Eduardo Jordan food pop-up.
Well, you can't buy tickets for literally anything else right now in Seattle, so this is it.
Yeah, you got to buy pre-sale tickets just to stay in form.
Dix also announced on Monday.
No. We need to talk about this for another second without even having had it yet. Part of me is just like, okay, so this is lasting for 3 days. What's the play here? Like, do we just buy tickets for the 16th and the 18th?
Maybe all 3 days.
I
don't think you do, because you gotta. I think that's almost unethical, because you want to give other people a chance to try it. Ask maybe Fantasy Genius what he would think about it.
I hear what you're saying about it, but when you hear these things described, I was talking again to Jan about having just a food conversation with Jan. And
did she bring up Taco
Bell? The upcoming Rolling Stones show. She was like, oh, that's something I might be interested in. And I'm like, yeah, Dix as cooked by the best chef in Seattle is something you might be interested in. There's like the Vince McMahon meme where he's getting interested and excited and then he falls off the chair.
Wait, I don't know if I do know that meme.
It's like one of the best memes on the internet where Vince McMahon is intrigued and then excited and then he falls off the chair.
So used to just seeing the Vince McMahon strutting entrance.
We can use that one too, because that's going to be us going to this food event. But...
Okay. Yeah, I do know this one. He falls off the chair though? I guess I didn't realize that was the description of it.
These items in order, you hear them, you're like, wait, a deluxe with Eduardo Jordan's cheese? Oh my god. Fries with Cajun sauce? But then the freaking kicker!
Yeah.
Spice sweet potato cookie shake? In October? Like, There is nothing that I want more than this in the entire world.
I can think of a few things, but it's high up there. Vaccine is definitely one of those things that's higher on my list.
We're good without basketball in Seattle. As long as we have this, we can buy advance tickets to this. I've got season tickets to the Eduardo Jordan at Dick's.
Well, there you go. We'll see if you have it. Right now, all you've done is like reserved your spot in line. You got to get to... Actually, you've placed your deposit for Kraken season tickets. You still have to actually make sure that you can get that your number comes up. All right, as I started to transition to earlier, Dix also announced on Monday a food truck that will begin operating in the late fall and is running an online survey asking fans where the Dix truck should go first as they are now more mobile and able to cover more of the Puget Sound region than they have been at their existing locations. You have no reaction to this?
Great. I'm always for more dicks. Like, it's just, if there is actually a location that needs a food truck the least, it feels like it's Dick's Drive-In in a lot of ways, because it's already so to-go catered.
The point is covering areas where it's not now.
Exactly. And I think that's the part that's exciting.
Yeah, that is the part that's exciting. They will not have fries at the Dick's food truck, just hamburgers and presumably ice cream related products, but no deep fryers.
You know, you couldn't get Mexi fries at a football game. You can't get fries at a Dick's truck. It's okay.
It is what it is. All right, should we move on to sports? The Mariners have moved within now a game and a half. They were briefly a game. I guess I haven't seen if the Astros played Tuesday night and updated with that. But they briefly were a game back of the Astros for the second place in the AL West, which is a playoff spot this season in the enlarged baseball playoff format. They're not going away yet. They are now two games back. The Astros did win Tuesday night, but they're only two games back despite having a minus 44 run differential to the Astros plus 8 run differential. Still, their playoff odds have dropped to under 4% according to the ESPN projections, because the additional wild cards beyond first and second in the two divisions now seeming likely out of their reach. They are 4.5 games back of the Toronto Blue Jays and 4 back of the Cleveland Indians, who currently occupy those two spots. The Mariners, after playing a doubleheader on Monday against the Oakland A's at T-Mobile Park, had Tuesday's game postponed, and the remainder of the series with the Giants moved to San Francisco due to the air quality issues that are plaguing Seattle right now in the midst of these terrible wildfires throughout the West Coast.
Pretty wild to see the games move to San Francisco for better air quality.
Yeah.
Was not something that I was expecting. And really just on the 2020 bingo, the baseball game canceled, initial games being canceled for COVID, so they had to do a doubleheader to make up for it. And then these games being canceled because of wildfire smoke. Just like, that's two different reasons we've never seen a Mariners game canceled before in our entire lives, and both happened in the same season. 2020.
It's really true. Yeah, the same month even. Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. It's good
that the
Kyle Lewis catch was pretty incredible. I said on that podcast that I went on, the Out West pod, that if there were more plays like that, I would be into baseball.
Would you?
I would consider it. Kyle Lewis is pretty awesome. He's by far the best thing about the Mariners.
That is a very specific thing to ask for also.
Just
the scenario that leads to a home run saving catch. Oh. It's like, it can't, that's not baseball's fault that doesn't happen more often.
I didn't say it was baseball's fault. I'm just
like, yeah,
saying.
If football, the entire sport, was only last-second Hail Marys, I'd watch more.
Well, you know, they did kind of create that with Red Zone. I don't know if you're aware of that. They made a more exciting form of football. It happened.
If they made every single football game after that Dolphins touchdown that they scored to beat the Patriots two seasons ago, if that was it, I'd be more into football.
That's such a great moment. What a time. Much, much better for the Dolphins than last week. We'll talk about that a bit later.
It's a very high standard to hold baseball to.
That's not the standard. I'm just saying that if that happened more, I would like baseball.
If the most exciting thing happened more, it wouldn't be exciting.
Fair.
There you go.
No.
You got there.
We're still debating what the mind-blown emoji is. That was happening in our chat. I was going to say, it's good that now baseball seems to have developed a standard around air quality, because the fact that the Mariners, it's kind of amazing they played the doubleheader on Monday when the air quality was worse. Tuesday it actually improved. We even saw some blue sky for brief moments here in the city or just outside the city of Seattle, at least where I am. That's the games they decided to move, but you know, the problem was not the decision to not play on Tuesday, it was the decision to play on Monday.
Develop some standards around air quality.
This problem is not going away. It's not going to be unique to 2020, as it turns out. Seattle Sounders, as we mentioned, with Jordan Morris, a historic 7-1 win last Thursday versus San Jose, the highest scoring match in Sounders MLS history. They scored 4 goals in the opening 20 minutes, tying the most ever in MLS. And watching this match in the midst of also conducting a fantasy draft and maybe watching the Thursday night football game,
a fantasy draft on Thursday?
Oh, no, I guess I wasn't. No, that's not true.
I was going to say, are you in another, you do another podcast? You're in other fantasy leagues I don't know about? What else don't I know, Pelton?
It was like, as I tweeted about, it was really like playing FIFA on an easy level, because San Jose's got a very aggressive man marking scheme where they don't, you know, play their entire back line as a unit, but are trying to go one on one. And the Sounders figure out the exploit to this, and then they just kept dribbling in and getting one on one with the keeper and getting easy shots. It was unlike anything I've ever seen in a high level soccer match.
Has everybody done this to San Jose?
They've given up a fair number of goals. I think it's like an average of 4 per match since the MLS's back tournament, since the season restarted, but this is the most they've given up.
This is their defensive strategy?
Apparently so.
I like it. Stick with it. Stick with it forever, San Jose.
According to the American Soccer Analysis version of expected goals, the Sounders total, which I think was a little over five in this one, was the third highest expected goals in an MLS game since it began being tracked in 2013.
Wow.
So that's how dominant they were. The Sounders got two goals and two assists from Jovan Jones, two goals from Raul Ruiz Diaz, and the result moved them up from seventh to fourth in the 538 Soccer Power Index rankings. So that's a taste of how dominant they were. They did briefly move into first in the West. Now, Sporting Kansas City, with a win over the weekend, moved 2 points ahead of the Sounders, but the Sounders still have a match in hand on Sporting Kansas City since they did not play this weekend. MLS last week announced three additional matches through the end of September, all again versus West Coast opponents for the Sounders. The Sounders will play LAFC once again at home on Friday. They visit Portland next Wednesday, their second trip to Portland and their third match against the Timbers since the restart. It's a lot of, it's like the Yankees Red Sox games on ESPN Sunday Night Baseball. It's just going to make the whole schedule out of Sounders.
Somehow they're playing every Sunday night.
And then conclude that stretch with a visit to the LA Galaxy, making up the match that was postponed during the Wildcat strike on Sunday the 27th. As part of this schedule phase, Canadian teams will now come to the U.S. and play U.S. opponents, including hosting matches at neutral sites of other MLS stadiums. Also, all of this schedule is contingent on the air quality. I don't know that we can be that confident that the match will be played on Friday, although hopefully things will be better by that point.
They're coming and playing. Canadian teams are – so basically it's a home match for the Canadian team.
It's like the Blue Jays playing in Buffalo, except, you know, in actual stadiums. I don't think they'll be playing the Timbers. It'll be, you know, some other team and them in Portland.
Two teams will just travel to a neutral site.
Correct.
I don't know where exactly – but they're still making teams play regional games.
Correct. Yes, they have not moved to full travel. Which is, surprised me a little bit, given that, like, I'm just traveling normally in the NFL, but obviously their travel budgets are a little different, because I think they're chartering to these matches in a way they don't always do during typical times.
Okay.
So maybe that's part of the why. And they also may still have the policy in place that you fly down day of game or fly to the location day of game. Speaking of matches that were postponed due to air quality issues, the Reign FC OL Reign match on Saturday against the Portland Thorns, which was going to be their first of the NWSL Fall Series, was originally postponed to Tuesday and then to September 30th due to the continuing air quality issues in Portland.
Is it maybe this is something that we didn't do 2 summers ago when the air quality was terrible?
It never got this bad.
You don't think so?
No. I don't think so.
Huh. Cool.
Seattle Storm capped the regular season last week, a 107-95 win on Wednesday versus Dallas. Had to work for that win and suffered a tough break, a couple of them in that game. Sue Bird collided with Dallas rookie Satu Savali during the fourth quarter, re-injuring her left knee. And during the third quarter, Brianna Stewart said she kind of stepped funny and felt an issue in her left foot / lower leg that eventually was diagnosed as an issue with scar tissue there that was kind of aggravated, but no structural damage. Both Bird and Stewart missed the final two games of the regular season. Without them, the Storm dominated the Phoenix Mercury 83-60 on Friday against a playoff-bound team that got a win on Tuesday night with a buzzer-beating three-pointer from Shea Petty to advance in the WNBA playoffs. But without those two on Sunday in the season finale, they lost 86-84 to the Las Vegas Aces in a game that determined the number one seed going into the WNBA playoffs. It was really a pretty impressive performance by the Storm without those two players, but the offense went cold late in the game without their shot creation. They were scoreless for nearly 5 minutes before a couple late Jewel Lloyd buckets made it a two-point game at the end. So they'll go into the playoffs as the number two seed, still get a bye to the semifinals, which begin on Sunday. So they we're watching Tuesday's games, and again Thursday, the outcome of Thursday's games will determine who they face in the semifinals. They'll face the higher seeded of the remaining teams, which, if the bracket holds to form, will be the LA Sparks, who they swept this year, but both of those games by single digits, including the game-winning three at the buzzer by Jewel Lloyd in one of those two matchups. So,
should we be expecting Sue and Brianna Stewart back for the playoffs, or?
We should, yes. Stewie talked to the media Tuesday, said that she intends to play. That's her plan. Coach Gary Kloppenberg said that's the plan for Sue Bird as well. They haven't returned to practice yet, but should late in the week. And they just have plenty of time because you've got this week off between games thanks to the double bye. So that's why so crucial to get in the WNBA.
Pretty nice. I like this Storm Aces rivalry.
It's becoming a thing. I mean, it'd be more fun, obviously, if you were able to do it, you know, in Seattle and Las Vegas with fans in the crowd. But, you know, they've both had very successful seasons, both finished 18-4 this year, but play in totally contrasting styles. You know, the Storm is all about speed and quickness, and shooting are really their strengths. The Aces, you know, taking the personality of their coach Bill Laimbeer, dominate the paint. They're actually not as good at shooting. He was a stretch five back in his day. They
really
shoot relatively few three-pointers.
Bill Laimbeer, really shoot the J?
Yeah. Yeah, him and Sam Perkins were like the original, and Jack Sikma.
You would
Bill Laimbeer in Seattle.
You're the Big Smooth? Shooting?
He wasn't as much of a three-point specialist as Perkins was in Seattle, but he was part of that evolutionary process for sure.
Really? Huh. I have no idea.
You'll have to look this up. I mean, you don't think about that because you only hear about him
elbowing people.
Right.
Yeah.
Which there was a lot of. There was no shortage of that. But there was also him. I mean, he didn't make that many threes, but 57 in a season at one point,
huh,
which was a lot for 1990.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Wow. So he knocks skulls and knocks down threes, stretches the floor.
The Laimbeer double-double was getting a flagrant foul and a three-pointer.
But I love the Bad Boy Aces team against the Storm. Like, that's fun.
Yeah, and they're not, like, noted for their dirty play or anything like that. But they're a physical team. The Storms really struggles to rebound playing against the Aces. They haven't had Sue Bird in either of those two matchups. We can talk about that plenty more if it does prove the WNBA Finals matchup. But we had our ESPNW panel did our playoff predictions today before the games tipped off. Every single one of us had Aces Storm in the finals with the Storm winning.
Mm-hmm. So you picked the one versus the two seed?
Right. I mean,
every single person picked the Storm to win?
Yeah.
How big
was
the
panel? I was a little
surprised
by that. I mean, six. It was like six or seven.
Huh.
I was a little surprised by that, though, given the Aces head-to-head wins. But Sue Bird hasn't played in either of those two games. And Sunday, neither team was going all out to win. The Aces were on the second half of a back-to-back. They didn't play Angel McCautry, who's been outstanding for them this season, in the second half of that game at all. And obviously, Bird and Stewart were both out for the Storm. Hmm. So we'll know more about the Storm's playoff future next week when we record. Moving on to UW football. ESPN reported Monday that the Pac-12's, quote, most aggressive date for return to play was mid-November, which lines up with what we've been hearing in terms of, you know, as they expect to get these antigen rapid test machines on campus at the end of September, and then a six-week, you know, training camp after that would put us in mid-November as a starting point for a Pac-12 football season. A necessary part of that is getting approval to practice and play in California and Oregon, and USC players sent a letter to California Governor Gavin Newsom on Tuesday requesting more flexibility in terms of those things. You know, they basically pointing out that professional teams have been allowed to practice and play there without fans. And, you know, once these antigen tests are up and running on Pac-12 campuses, their testing process should be, you know, every bit as rigorous and, in fact, have a more rapid turnaround than what we see in the NFL.
Yeah.
And it sounds like we're going to get Big Ten football at some point here.
Oh, yeah.
And probably more earlier than mid-November.
I don't get what the plan is. I mean, are all these conferences just going to have regular season champions and then we'll go from there? Or...
I mean, I think the Big Ten wants to be able to play a legitimate conference season before the bowl games are chosen. Before the college football playoff makes its selection.
Pretty soon here.
Their plan is to play in mid-October, I think, as I understand it. So
but they haven't started
would still
camp
be behind.
At all?
I don't know about that, whether they're practicing right now.
Okay. I mean, I guess at the very least, obviously, you know, I've been pretty consistent about this point that colleges shouldn't be playing football this fall for myriad reasons. But at the very least, it feels like the Pac-12 is doing their best to try to make it as safe as possible for the players.
Yeah.
Larry Scott does not want a situation where the head coach of a team is saying, not all, but most of the players on the team have contracted coronavirus. Like no. That, the flippancy that story is taken with about LSU at this point is a little shocking.
Is it though?
Well, I think it just sort of goes to show. I mean, granted, there's not going to be outrage from the people of Louisiana, but it just sort of goes to show. Like, I mean, so many people have been infected throughout the country, right?
Yeah.
That it's almost hard to be shocked by any of this, you know, and granted, as far as we know, every college athlete has recovered and has been healthy after that.
I mean, I think there was one athlete who had COVID and passed away.
At a major college?
No, not at a major college.
Still. We've just moved on. Well, that's cool.
Yeah, it was at California University of Pennsylvania. I don't know that they're even playing football, but it was a football player just to show the risk. Yeah, they had canceled the school's football season in July, but just to show the risk to healthy young individuals.
Huh.
It's really a tragedy. So.
Yeah, but at the very least, they're trying. It makes sense to me that they're going to play a season. They kind of need to. You have to keep up at this point. I think the expectation for the Pac-12 and the Big Ten was we're going to cancel the season, and so is everybody else eventually. And then everybody else didn't, and all of a sudden it sort of put them behind the ball. Granted, they have state restrictions where, you know, like Larry Scott has to worry about shit that these other conferences don't have to worry about. You know, you can have states like Florida where the outbreaks are worse than almost anywhere in the country, but they're still fans of the Jaguars game or whatever. Like, that's just not something that the governors.
Are fans of the Jaguars game?
Absolutely, there were fans of the Jaguars game. And there will be fans of the Dolphins game this week, and there'll be fans of the Cowboys game this week. Like, Big 12 and SEC and ACC country, the politicians just, they don't care that much. And that's something that Gavin Newsom has to think about, that the commissioners of the SEC and the Big 12 and the ACC don't have to think about.
That Larry Scott has to think about, yeah. Yeah.
They call him Gavin Scott.
You called him Gavin Newsom.
Gavin Newsom, sorry. Larry Scott has to think about the policies of Gavin Newsom.
Correct. The governors have to think about it there. They're just choosing not to.
I don't know if they do have to think about it.
Okay, they should be thinking about
they
it,
have
at least.
Moved on. But it'll be fun to have there be a season. It'll be very interesting to see how it plays out and really even how many players play in this season.
Right.
If it's going to be a season where it's just the Pac-12 and you don't play anybody after that and there's no... You know, it's just like you get crowned Pac-12 champion and that's it. I think there are a lot of, you know, potential high draft picks who are not going to play this year because I don't really see what you gain from it.
I don't know. I mean, you still have the opportunity to improve your draft stock by how you play. Like, there's greater risk if your stock is currently higher. But, you know, from that logic, it's not really clear why anyone would ever play their senior season, basically.
There you go. You got there.
We'll see.
What is the Reddit? There's a Reddit page where somebody gets to the point. Self-aware wolves. That's what you just did. You got to the self-aware wolves page. But I mean, you saw it with Pinay Sewell in Oregon sitting out. Like, if you're going to be a top 10 draft pick, why play college football?
Sure, but that's different than if you're, you know, a mid-round draft pick who has the chance to elevate your stock or decline.
No, I'm saying if you're basically a guaranteed first-round draft, we talked about this before, like, Trevor Lawrence should not be playing this year.
But we are seeing players like that sit out even in the SEC and the Big Ten.
Yeah,
I think we're seeing some of them. I mean,
Rondell Moore sat out because there's this ill-fated Big Ten season that's coming. But it's just like, if the school is not going to worry about your health and you're basically guaranteed to be a first-round draft pick, there's literally no reason to play college football.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to think of because you're in that moment. Like, I don't begrudge Trevor Lawrence for doing it, but like...
I mean, it's his choice.
Only bad can happen from it. You know, we saw what happened. Like, it didn't affect Tua that much in terms of draft stock, but like, bad can happen from playing football irrelevant of the pandemic that's going on.
Well, it seems like based on the timetable the Pac-12 has laid out, we will be able to get through basically all of Let's Remember a Season, but we continue on with week 3 for the 2000 Huskies.
I don't mean to sound morbid here, but like, this particular season that we're talking about is almost like the perfect example of only bad can happen from playing college sports.
Yes, and the worst that could happened, unfortunately, during the 2000 season. But week 3 that saw the Huskies travel to face Colorado, they moved up to number 9 in the polls after that big win over Miami in week 2. And let's say that this was a different homecoming return to where you previously coached than when Coach Pete went back to Boise State a couple of years after coming to UW. This was year 2 and at UW for Rick Neuheisel, who left amid tons of controversy because of the fact that, you know, Colorado didn't see itself as a stepping stone at all, and the allegations that he recruited his Colorado players to come join him at UW, transfer and join him. Gary Barnett, who replaced Neuheisel as head coach, went 7-5 in his first season in Boulder. They started the 2000 campaign ranked, but lost 28-24 to Colorado State in their season opener and 17-14 at number 11 USC in week 2. Zach Colvin, their starting quarterback, to open the season, dealt with injuries and was replaced by JC transfer Bobby Pesavento for the UW game. Starting running back Cortland Johnson also missed the game with injury. Not really a lot of big names on this Colorado roster that you like look back and like, oh, that was a fun player. Their biggest name was tight end Daniel Graham, who would be a first-round pick of the New England Patriots. And the game itself was surprisingly close given how the season would play out for both of these teams. The Colorado offense mustered just 243 yards, but the Buffs still led 7-3 through three quarters thanks to an interception return for a touchdown by Phil Jackson. Not that Phil Jackson. And another interception by Michael Lewis. Not that Michael Lewis.
You must have gotten so excited when you read those names.
I did. If there was a game that I thought of looking through the recap and the box score of this one, it was like that UW game at Cal, except that in this case they did not choose to inexplicably bench their senior starting quarterback.
Oh, God.
The Huskies offense, you know, the interception return for a touchdown and everything. The Huskies offense finally got on track late, scoring the go-ahead touchdown on the second play of the fourth quarter and then scoring again, punching it in again on their next drive for a 17-7 lead. The Buffaloes then marched 97 yards for their lone offensive touchdown with 3:46 left to make it 17-14, but didn't get the ball back until inside the final minute, and the Huskies forced a fumble to secure the win. I don't know about you. I have zero memory of this game.
Literally, no. We must not have watched it, maybe.
I mean, I during the 2000 season, was working every other Saturday, and so that caused me to miss some of the games that were during the day on Saturdays, so that must have been what happened here, I assume.
This is going to sound ridiculous, but is there a chance that I was at Sausage Fest this weekend?
It is possible the time would line up.
Not a Sausage Fest, the Sausage Fest.
Shouts to, I don't know if anyone but the famous Cousin Katie among the listener will know Christ the King Sausage Fest in Richland, Washington, but quite a time.
I feel like there's a chance that I was at that during this game.
We certainly had been during Husky games in the past, the Air Force game the previous year.
If you could take the energy of Oktoberfest in Berlin and translate it to Richland, Washington at a Catholic elementary school, that is Sausage Fest.
Very much so.
Looking at this game, UW didn't play badly. I mean, they outgained Colorado by about 150 yards.
It was mostly the turnovers, the two interceptions that caused them to struggle to score.
And two fumbles. But again, another one of those games where you look at Tui and you're just like, wow, 51.7% completion percentage. the 6.9 yards per attempt, two picks, and a 50% completion percentage is like, you're getting benched after that in modern NFL or modern college football. But this was a game where, he didn't carry the ball great, but UW still kind of marched the ball down the field and gained a bunch of yards, just didn't really put points on the board.
I mean, one thing the recap talked about, we're going to get to this in a second here with a similar modern precedent or equivalent. Tui's ability on third downs, anytime you got inside third and four, the fact that he was a threat to either run or throw in those situations made him very difficult to stop. So you had a lot of these long, methodical drives that the Huskies matriculated the ball down the field, as the great Keith Jackson would say.
That is okay. The most 2000s way of describing football.
Oh.
Matriculating the ball down the field, having a quarterback who could run or pass, but not doing that until third down. You got to wait until it's manageable.
I mean, I think he was doing some running on first and second down too, as it turned out.
Look at Jeremy Stevens going for 100 yards though.
Yeah.
I mean, these Husky receivers were not great.
It was a relatively weak receiving core for such a good team. So nobody else had more than one catch among the actual wide receivers. Braxton Clement had four out of the backfield. So the rest of the season for Colorado, they lost to yet another top 10 opponent in Kansas State in their Big 12 opener before turning to true freshman Craig Oaks at quarterback and beating Texas A&M. They would finish the season 3-8 before bouncing back to win the Big 12 in 2001 in Gary Barnett's best season in Boulder.
I was going to say this is sort of a lost era for Colorado football, but maybe the last couple of decades have been a lost era for Colorado football.
Yeah, except when the Huskies visited last year.
They won a game.
Let's wrap it up with the Seahawks coming off that 38-25 win Sunday at Atlanta in their season opener and now getting ready for an exciting Week 2 matchup. Sunday Night Football under the bright lights. We're going to see replays of Super Bowl 49 about 10,000 times between now and the end of the game on Sunday night. And I don't know what to tell you. It's still too soon.
I think we have to look back to another Sunday night.
2016?
Right? Seahawks Patriots 2016 coming off a thrilling tie in the desert.
I don't think that's what we were coming off of at that point. We were coming off a little election earlier in the week. I don't know if you call that one.
God.
Also, I don't think that was the week after the tie. I think that it was a couple weeks after the tie because I was still in the Bay Area that Sunday night. The Seahawks played on Monday night the week before. I think they played on Monday night the week before. Was that the Tyrod Taylor Buffalo game?
I swear these were back-to-back weeks. They wouldn't have played Sunday night two consecutive weeks, right?
They played Monday night the week before. It was the Tyrod Taylor game. Yep.
Oh, 31-25
win over Buffalo. There was actually two games in between. There was also a loss at New Orleans, the OPI game, the Jermaine Kearse OPI game.
About so many of these losses. Okay. This is not one that I'm curious about. Let's go back to the last time that these two teams faced each other, because that's really the most important precedent for this game. Sunday night.
Absolutely.
Sunday night. That's an MVP quarterback on one side, Russell Wilson on the other side. Look, they look almost exactly the same.
Russell Wilson, 25 of 37 for 348 yards and 3 touchdowns in that win. This was the CJ Pro size game, yes. 17 carries for 66 yards, 7 catches and 7 targets for 87 yards. He was the Seahawks' leading rusher and a receiver in this game. Probably still the highlight of CJ Procise's career, which I believe it was the following week that was Philadelphia when he was injured.
Will this week be the DJ Dallas game?
Oh, only if he's active.
Any other thoughts before we talk New England about last Sunday's game against Atlanta?
I mean, one thing we didn't talk about in the recap that we should discuss is that both the Falcons and the Seahawks took a knee during the opening kickoff in active unity coordinated by the quarterbacks Russell Wilson and Matt Ryan of the respective teams. And fortunately, as there were no fans at Mercedes-Benz Stadium, no one was able to boo this particular act of unity.
Oh, that's nice. That's good stuff. Yeah.
The other thing worth noting is the Seahawks came out of that game relatively healthy. Philip Dorsett missed it with a sore foot, and Rasheem Green briefly left the game with a shoulder injury but was able to return. And that's, you know, long-term, I think, probably the biggest thing, that, you know, you stay healthy from that one.
I mean, pretty much completely healthy from the game, which is exciting. You know, we definitely saw a few injuries throughout the NFL, even among, you know, NFC contenders, like the Michael Thomas injury that we saw in New England, George Kittle being a little bit banged up. Coming out of that game with such a confident victory and then being healthy after it. But I think also still just the lingering takeaway from that game, we talked about this on Sunday, is how the Seahawks scored those 38 points.
By passing?
What? Passing?
By passing?
Yeah. By letting Russ...
The forward pass, I believe they call it, right?
It's not even just the forward pass. It's the forward pass on first down, and then get this, second down too sometimes.
Second and long in particular, where they passed every single time they had it. By the way, if you haven't watched our video from PeltonCast Live from Home, going over the history of the phrase "let Russ cook" with DJ Infrared and Zach Whitman, "let Russ cook" pioneers, be sure to do so. It is a treat.
Is this something that, given all the chatter that we've heard, that we're going to continue to see from the Seahawks offense? Is this a one-game anomaly because of the Falcons? Is this a game plan issue? Or is this the Seahawks now?
I don't think it's the Seahawks now. I mean, Pete Carroll has talked at practice this week about they want to get Chris Carson more carries than the 7 he had. They want to get the running backs in general more carries. One thing Bill Barnwell pointed out in his Monday column looking at the quarterbacks in week 1 that I thought was a worthwhile point is that if you look at the pass heaviest Seahawks games in recent vintage, they have tended to be on turf and indoors. This wasn't technically indoors because they had the roof open at Mercedes-Benz Stadium, but it played like that. And, you know, that's where Russell Wilson historically has been most successful, when the elements aren't a factor. And so that may have been part of their thinking in this game plan specifically.
Interesting, huh? So you don't think this is 2020, we're in a new year, and this is a new Seahawks offense?
I mean, I think they're going to open it up more than they did last season. I'm optimistic about that. As I said on the pod on Sunday, I think the fact that this was the first game of the season, you know, this is something you plan all off season. I remember back to specifically, like, you know, when Green Bay and San Francisco had played in the playoffs in 2012, I guess, and Colin Kaepernick had used the read option to run all over the Packers, and then they spent the entire offseason prepping for it, and then Kaepernick threw for like 300-plus yards in week 1 against the Packers.
He just didn't read option anymore. They passed, but then the plays broke down.
Yeah. So there's a certain statement in what you do in week 1, but I don't think it's going to stay at this level forever.
Okay. I think we can live with that. I mean, Ben mentioned this. The most important thing was seeing success. And
right,
that they had success passing. I mean, they were the team that passed the ball on first and second down most of anybody in the league. And that is really what Let Russ Cook is about. The thing that we'd heard was that Russell Wilson wasn't necessarily saying that he needs to pass the ball more. He was saying, going to the team, supposedly, having a conversation that he wants to be more aggressive earlier in the game. If we know that the offense is good in the fourth quarter, why not make the whole game out of the fourth quarter? Yep. And from what we saw, that seemed to be the case, aside from the second quarter. Of course, ignore the second quarter. Don't look at it. It didn't happen. But, you know, I think this is going to be one of the most telling games. Obviously, it's the next game on the schedule. But this game is going to be very telling for what the offense is going to look like going forward, playing what we think is a much better defense than the Atlanta defense in New England. You know, there's not a lot that we can glean from one game against the Dolphins, but last season was one of the best defenses in the league. Have had some losses from that defense, but still looked pretty good. And it'll be interesting to see how they attack this New England defense on Sunday.
It will. Let's talk about the Patriots, who beat the Dolphins 21-11 in their opener. Miami did get within 14-11 in the fourth quarter, but the Patriots used a 10-play, 75-yard drive to put the game away and then intercepted Fitzmagic, Ryan Fitzpatrick, in the end zone late in this one to make the final score hold up. The Patriots held the ball for 34 minutes and 50 seconds in this game and had three drives of 10-plus plays, one of which ended with a fumble by N'Keal Harry at the goal line for a touchback. Their 3-minute, 52-second average time of drive was the second longest in Week 1, and the teams had nine drives apiece in this game, tied for the fewest in the NFL. By comparison, the Seahawks had 11, and the Falcons had 12 in their matchup. In his debut with the Patriots, replacing Tom Brady, Cam Newton went 15 of 19 for 155 yards. He ran 15 times for 75 yards and two touchdowns, which was the second most runs in a game during his NFL career.
Wow.
In a notable contrast to last season, when he had just five rushes total in his two games that he played before he was ruled out for the season. It was interesting. I looked this up. Historically, he has run 20% more than his season average in Week 1. There's no clear trend after that, so it's not like he's wearing down over the course of the season and running less. I don't know if it's just like that's a game plan they're putting in, as we talked about, that that's something they want to show opponents in Week 1, but it's interesting. This also notable. In Cam Newton's career, when he runs the ball at least 12 times, his teams are 14-2-1. One of those two losses coming against the Seahawks.
There we go.
So I guess it's let Russ cook and let Cam run. QBR ranked Cam Newton 7th overall among quarterbacks in Week 1. He was number 2 among quarterbacks in rushing EPA, just number 21 in passing EPA. His primary targets in this one were Julian Edelman and Harry, who combined for 13 of the 19 targets. Harry averaged just 6.5 yards per target on his catches in addition to the fumble, while Edelman was at 8.1. The Patriots used running back by committee, with Sony Michel getting most of the carries at 10, 7 for Rex Burkhead, 5 for James White, and 4 for undrafted Arizona rookie J.J. Taylor.
Wow,
I really should remember better than I do.
You don't remember J.J. Taylor?
I mean, I don't not remember him. I just don't specifically. Also, I didn't remember that he was like 5'5", which was a big talking point last week. That was the distribution with Damian Harris on IR, their 2019 third-round pick. He's out at least the first 3 weeks. Traditionally, Sony Michel on the field has meant run, and James White on the field has meant pass, with Rex Burkhead is more of kind of, you know, the could go either way, less of a tell when he's out there. As you alluded to, the Patriots' defense was
hit hard. Let's talk about their offense quickly for a second here. This is the most Panther shit ever.
Oh, like, my God. It's so Seahawks-Panthers.
In the way that they ran their offense around Cam, it's revolutionary for the Patriots in a lot of ways, but, like, this is what we've seen from the Panthers for a long time. They don't really make a lot of explosive plays necessarily, but they Marcus Tuiasosopo 2000
Bingo.
The ball down the field. And it is so frustrating to watch, and we've seen this game over and over and over again. And you're like, wow, the Seahawks are getting crushed in this game. Their defense is dying, but they've given up 12 points.
The thought I always have is like, how do you possibly stop Cam Newton? You get to like 3rd and 3, and that's like, that's supposed to be a situation where you have a chance to get off the field, but he's always just going to pick up the 3 yards.
it has happened forever, but they don't score a ton of points aside from the one playoff game in Carolina. Like, that is the one time that there's been an explosive game, and I think that even kind of had to do situationally a lot of it. This is going to be a Seahawks-Panthers game more than this is going to be a Seahawks-Patriots game.
100%. 100%. I mentioned those drive totals from week one. If you go back to the Seahawks-Panthers classic games, in 2013 there was a combined 17 drives between the two teams. In 2014 there was 18 drives, and then in the 2014 playoffs there were 19 drives. And so what that means is every drive becomes so critical. You can't afford to give one away.
Now, so I think the only difference between these teams is those 13, 14 later Seahawks teams wanted to run the ball, it's shocking saying this, more than it seems like the current Seahawks do, or at least from what we saw last week. Seahawks, and maybe even last season a little bit, they're getting down the field a little bit faster than they have in the past. I wouldn't be surprised if there were more possessions in this game than we've seen from some of those classic Seahawks-Panthers games because of the Seahawks offense somehow being a more aggressive offense earlier in the game. But tell us about the Patriots defense.
Well, by the way, the final scores in 2013 in the regular season at Carolina, that was in week one. Seahawks won 12-7.
I was going to say 12-7. That was...
At Carolina in 2014, they won 13-9.
Love it. That was a duel, 13-9 versus the 12-7 game that came before it.
A shootout, you would say. As you alluded, the Patriots defense was hit hard by their NFL high 8 opt-outs as a team as compared to 1 for the Seahawks, losing starting linebacker Dante Hightower. Defensive lineman, maybe? They definitely had an opt-out.
I cannot think of who that was.
It was not a particularly... Oh, Chance Warmack. It was an offensive lineman. Okay. Dante Hightower, their excellent linebacker, and then Patrick Chung at safety, two starters who opted out from the Patriots defense. They also lost starting lineman Marcus Cannon. They still boast an excellent secondary led by reigning defensive player of the year, Stephon Gilmore. That secondary picked Fitzmagic 3 times on Sunday, including one by Gilmore. So,
yeah, it'll be interesting to see the Seahawks versus this defense. I mean, again, that sort of the linebackers in particular is the place. I mean, they're going to run the ball more in this game. And I think the Patriots are going to game plan for the Seahawks passing a little bit more than the Falcons did, better than the Falcons did. I would love to see, honestly, if I had a takeaway from that, from week one that was a little bit unnerving, was the run blocking was not very good. And it's hard to tell whether that's the line or whether that was just the Falcons were going to stop the run at all costs, so help me God. But if it was the line and the line cannot run block and we see them sort of revert back to like 2007 type run blocking, this could be a long game for the Seahawks offense.
Or it could be a short game for the Seahawks offense because they may not be on the field very much given how much Carolina is likely to possess the ball.
Or, yeah, I mean, I suppose there's a very good chance that this is one of those games that we look up and it's just like, it's the fourth quarter already. You're like, wait, there's 8 minutes left in the fourth quarter. The Patriots just got the ball and they're definitely going to have an 8-minute drive here.
I hate these games so much.
Oh, it's the worst. Everything.
I love them after they've happened.
It's funny that Cam Newton is like perceived as like an explosive quarterback, but our understanding of Cam Newton is as this sort of like matriculating, pick up a first down, 6 yards type quarterback.
You know, it turns out that not every defense has Earl Thomas to patrol the deep ball.
I think that this is one. Well, I guess just on the Seahawks offense for a second, like they're going to run the ball more. We know that. I could see the tight ends getting involved in this game a little bit more than they were beforehand. And it might be just a tad bit more that, you know, maybe number 3 receiver, maybe David Moore is getting some action. We don't really know what the status of Josh Gordon is. I think we would expect him not to be playing in this one. But it could be, this one could be instead of 100 yards to DK Metcalf, this could be a little bit more to other places throughout the offense.
I would say one of the things
even,
I'm really...
Carson out of the backfield again.
Yeah. I would say one of the things, I mean, that was very successful against the old school Patriots when their linebackers particularly struggled to cover. I would say one of the things I'm really excited to see in this game is how the Patriots match up with the Seahawks receivers. Like, the classic Belichick move is to put Stephon Gilmore and basically the number two receiver and then double cover the other guy. But I'm not sure who exactly that is for the Seahawks at this point, like how you would match that up.
It's a tough one. I assume that they would treat... You're not going to double cover DK, though. I don't know.
I mean, maybe you are. Gilmore is probably more of a physical match for Lockett. So,
man, that is... yeah. No, we will definitely see how they're going to approach that situation. And it's a good secondary, but they have had losses at secondary. I don't think we can just pencil them in as being as good as they were last season.
No, I definitely don't think so either.
And with the one game that they've played being against, we might love him, and he did have a great game against the Patriots at the end of last year. But Ryan Fitzpatrick, like, this is what Ryan Fitzpatrick is. He's going to throw three picks sometimes.
That is definitely the case. Look, you can't be a boomer bust quarterback without some bust.
And the Dolphins hung around in that game. Like, without seeing a ton of it, it was one of those games, obviously being opposite the Seahawks, where you're just like, the Dolphins still kind of have a chance here. Feels like every time we're seeing this game updated, it is Cam doing something and keeping a drive alive. But the Dolphins hung around into the fourth quarter of that game. And that was, I mean, these teams aren't comparable, right? Like, I think we have to approach this as feeling fairly good about the situation. The Seahawks have beaten Cam a number of times. You would have to probably say that this is a worse team than Cam has been on, especially offensively. The weapons are not very good. And
oh, Kelvin Benjamin is not walking through that door.
What?
Kelvin Benjamin is not walking through that door. Greg Olsen is walking through that door, but he's walking to the Seahawks locker room, friend.
But I'm saying, like, having Jamal Adams around, Quandre Diggs around to be chasing Cam Newton and bringing down Cam Newton, like, that is a good thing to have.
I mean, the team speed that the Seahawks have in the secondary is, yes, definitely a positive here.
So, and just the tackling.
The other thing I'm excited to see is, like, how Jamal Adams gets used in this game.
He's going to be everywhere. Right?
Hopefully.
Like, the speed that Jamal Adams has and the speed on the ball is, like, we've never seen anything like it on the Seahawks.
I mean, we've seen some things like it.
We have never seen anybody as physical as Jamal Adams, as good of a tackler as Jamal Adams. He has the speed of Earl Thomas and the tackling ability of Cam Chancellor. It is the perfect combination of those two players. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but, like, if you could take our two legendary safeties and turn them into one, which with each of their strengths, that's Jamal Adams. And if you were to make a player who is a perfect player to defend Cam Newton, it is those abilities.
I mean, Earl Thomas did literally break Rob Gronkowski's back during that 2016 game. It was a pretty good hit he laid on Rob Gronkowski.
I'm not saying that Earl couldn't hit because he could, but, like,
it's not you don't look at it as much of a strength as with Jamal Adams. I agree.
No, and there were tackles. Look, Earl can clean up some tackles, but, like, Jamal Adams he moves at a different speed.
You certainly weren't going to see him come up with a lot of sacks, Earl Thomas.
Like, I don't know. We should always be thrilled to watch Russell Wilson and thankful to watch Russell Wilson every Sunday. I'm excited to watch Jamal Adams play this game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Like, having another chance to see what he can do against, you know, like, what seems like an offense that we've seen a lot of different times before, despite the fact that they haven't played the Patriots that many times. It's like, maybe Cam is in some third and 11s, and he's not that accurate in some third and 11s. Maybe the makeables aren't as makeable, right? I honestly could see the Seahawks winning this game comfortably. I've talked myself into it here.
Wow. You really swung hard from last week with your pessimism heading to Atlanta. One other thing I wanted to know about the Patriots.
This is a compliment to Atlanta, for the record. And look, Atlanta's offense was good.
Yeah, it was, and
but
then they went 0 for 4 and 4th down.
Better than you would have expected them.
Yeah, oh, undoubtedly. Something I found interesting is how the Patriots are using the new roster rules. They have no kicker on their 53-man roster, with two of them, Nick Folk, the veteran and fifth round who kicked for them last year, and fifth round pick Justin Rohrwasser on their practice squad. They can elevate each of those to the active squad twice before needing to add a kicker to their 53-man roster. Folk got the call to kick on Sunday and missed his only field goal attempt from 45 yards just before halftime. You seem perplexed.
Is this brilliant, or is this just like overthinking it?
I can't tell if it's galaxy brain or not. I mean, I assume part of their logic is like, well, if we cut players at the end of training camp, like, no one's going to claim a kicker, are they? Whereas they might claim this, you know, backup guard we have.
I guess so. Didn't seem like that many players were claimed this year.
No, very few players were claimed, as a matter of fact.
They're just... So we don't know who the kicker will be heading in this game.
Yes, we cannot say for certain whether it will be Folk or Rohrwasser.
Wow. Pete must be shaking. So the assumption would be that if either... I mean, I guess the one way you look at it is either Folk kicks and wins the job this weekend, or they're just going to go back and forth if they got two shots at each.
Yeah, I mean, they could hypothetically add more kickers to the practice squad, and then they'd have two chances to elevate them to the roster.
Wow, Steven Gostkowski might be available soon.
Well, he sure might. I'm surprised he isn't yet.
Oh, man. Okay, well, on that note, the rematch of...
Are we going to do chances of victory?
Hold on, no, I'm saying...
Okay.
In... the much-anticipated rematch of 2016 Week 10. Percentage chances of victory.
You know, one of the things I haven't looked at or seen any analysis of is what home field advantage looked like in Week 1 of the season, especially for teams that are traveling cross-country, which the Seahawks managed to do and come away with a victory. I guess I'm going to go, like, 60%, but I don't feel great about that. Really? It's like a 60% that's closer to 55 than it is to 65. I don't know how that makes sense, but that's how it is. Don't do the math on that one.
It's like a... Okay. I'm going 68% in this one.
So, is there any particular reason you settled on 68%?
We know how... There are less unknowns about the Seahawks than there are about the Patriots.
I guess that's probably true.
The Seahawks are a relatively similar offense and defense. I mean, they're a relatively similar team to what we saw last year, to a team that won a playoff game last year. The Patriots faded pretty severely at the end of last season, and despite the fact that they've changed quarterbacks and maybe have upgraded a quarterback, we honestly don't know. The rest of the roster just isn't as deep as it was. The Seahawks are playing, for whatever it means, their first home game of the season. They look to be employing an analytic perspective in some way. And all of those things adding up, look, you don't want to feel too confident against a Bill Belichick-led Patriots team. And if this was week 10, week 11, something like that, and we knew a little bit more about what the Patriots look like, I think I could obviously see it being different, but I think this will be an up and down season for the Patriots. I'm not the biggest Cam believer. I think
we know.
What?
Distraction, Cam.
I'm just saying, like, I think Cam Newton is a good quarterback, but, like, you know, he's worth an 11-point victory against the Dolphins. Like, I think people are getting a little bit ahead of themselves for a victory against a team that was widely considered to be the worst team in the NFL last year. Like, I don't think
that was last year, and they were better than we expected last year. So the Dolphins, I mean, it remains to be seen. I would say
the Dolphins are not a good team.
I would say I was somewhat more impressed. I was somewhat more impressed with the Patriots' defense in Week 1 than their offense, as well as Cam play.
Have we seen DVOA for this week, or is that not unveiled yet?
We have seen DVOA for this week. Okay. You know who's number two?
Who?
The New England Patriots.
The Patriots were?
Yeah. I believe the Seahawks are number 4.
What?
So it's a showdown. Two top 5 teams.
Wow, DVOA Bowl coming. They really were number 2 in DVOA?
Correct.
That is a
third in. Contrary to what I just said, since they had that consistency on offense, third in offense, fifth in defense, 25th in special teams, Seahawks were second in offense, 21st in defense, third in special teams.
Oh, here we go. But yeah, I'm not ready to hang the mission accomplished banner either for the Let Russ Cook era or for the Patriots after this one victory versus the Dolphins. And I think part of it, you'd sort of have to go back to who's bringing back more consistency, who is bringing back better players, you know? And I think you've got Russell Wilson on one side and you have Cam Newton on a second team on the other side. And what that amounts to is the Seahawks are a significantly better team.
Well, I hope that's right.
And that's how we got to a 68% chance of victory.
I was mostly asking how you got to like 68 as opposed to a round number.
Because people, you feel more confident. You do better when you don't give a round number. Okay, I mean, these DVOA rankings have the Jaguars as the number 3 team in the league. So
I mean, it's week 1. These things happen. There is evidence that suggests that predictions that are made that aren't rounded tend to be more accurate. But
that's what,
man,
I
that is hard for me
you.
To. It's hard for me to square with the idea that it's false confidence to be able to like, oh, I can definitely determine between the difference between 67% and 68% chance.
You're the one who's parsing the 60% that's closer to 55 than it is to 65.
I told you that was irrational. I didn't justify that at all.
I'm telling you, it's precisely a 68%. The total DVOA of 88 for Baltimore is quite something.
Yeah, they were pretty impressive. Felt good about that Lamar Jackson pick, I'll tell you that much.
Anyway, I'm going to wait a second to judge anything with regards to DVOA with the Jags at number 3 and Washington at number 6.
Well, that's why they also have the Dave metric, which incorporates their preseason projections, and the Seahawks up to 5th there.
And the Patriots at 11th.
Yeah.
So I think, wow, Washington 30th in Dave, number 6 in DVOA.
It's the least popular Dave in Washington since the movie about the president. No. No good.
Who starred in that one? Was that
Kevin Kline?
I was going to say, was that Kevin Kline? That's what I thought too. So it has to be Kevin Kline. Isn't Kevin Kline British though?
I don't think Kevin Kline is British, no.
Really?
It is Kevin Kline, yes.
All right. Yeah, it was a Kevin Kline joint.
He's
it literally
in
says
Louis.
Kevin Kline, American actor.
I did not know he was married to Phoebe Cates.
Anyway, that's how I got to 68%. Honestly, don't make me go higher. Look, I could get all the way up to 73%.
All right, let's all remain calm here.
I'm feeling good about this one. Look, if Rohrwasser is kicking on Sunday, I'm feeling good about this game, though. And maybe the wheels have fallen off the Patriots bus conversation happens after this one.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
Most likely it'll be like a 19-8 game. The Seahawks will sort of arm's length the Patriots, but win it comfortably.
All right. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.